This is How Sound, the backstory to great audio storytelling. How Sound comes to you from PRX and Transom. I'm Rob Rosenthal. Things are a mess these days, yeah? As I record this in late April, more than 50,000 people have died from COVID-19 in the U.S., nearly 200,000 worldwide. Schools and businesses remain closed. Millions of people are out of work. The political situation is just calamitous. Hospital staff are pushed to the edge. Reporters and food workers and first responders and others, they continue to place themselves in harm's way daily. Yeah, it's a mess. And while all seems bewildering and anxiety-provoking, there's a suggestion that for many people, this moment is the great pause. An opportunity to take time to consider what's important, what provides pleasure and meaning. Well, with that in mind, I want to use this episode of How Sound to take a pause and ask you, producers and reporters and editors and podcast makers and sound artists, all of you who listen to How Sound, I want to ask, what do you stand for? When you produce your stories and put together an episode of a podcast and send it out into the world, why? What gives your work meaning? For me, I often find the answer to that question in NPR's mission statement. And you don't need to work for NPR to draw inspiration from the statement. I don't. Technically, NPR's mission statement is called National Public Radio Purposes. It was written in 1970 by Bill Siemering. In fact, 2020 is the 50th anniversary of the statement. That's another reason to pause. I have always found the sentiments in the statement to be so affirming and powerful. I mean, literally, I get goosebumps, especially when I hear Bill read them.
It begins, National Public Radio will serve the individual. It will promote personal growth. It will regard the individual differences with respect and joy rather than derision and hate. It will celebrate the human experience as infinitely varied rather than vacuous and banal. It will encourage a sense of active, constructive participation rather than apathetic helplessness. The total service should be trustworthy, enhance intellectual development, expand knowledge, deepen oral aesthetic enjoyment, increase the pleasure of living in a pluralistic society, and result in a service to listeners which makes them more responsive, informed human beings, and intelligent, responsible citizens of their communities and the world.
I gave Bill a call to have an open chat about those words and the early days of NPR, and to be honest, for the inspiration. Bill says he came to these ideas, well, just from living. And it was the 60s. Such aspirations were in the air. But Bill says the sentiments in the mission statement also stem from his time as a station manager at WBFO in Buffalo, New York. In 1968, the assassination of Martin Luther King sparked riots in Buffalo and around the country. And in response, the station built a studio in the Black community. Residents broadcast programs directly from that neighborhood on WBFO. That was a radical idea. Still is.
I realized the importance of amplifying voices. It wasn't giving voice. They had a voice, but it wasn't amplified.
In addition to writing the mission statement for NPR, Bill was the network's first program director. He guided the development of the flagship news program, All Things Considered. He helped shape the program's sound and direction, and he wrote these guiding words for the program. You can hear the echoes of Bill's experience at WBFO.
It will not substitute superficial blandness for genuine diversity of regions, values, and cultural and ethnic minorities, which comprise American society. It would speak with many voices and many dialects. The editorial attitude would be that of inquiry, curiosity, concern for the quality of life, critical, problem-solving, and life-loving.
Thousands of young people came to Washington willing to risk being arrested in order to end the war. They went into the streets this morning to stop the government from functioning by clogging many Washington roads during this morning's rush hour.
For many demonstrators, Bill told me a hair-raising story about the first broadcast of All Things Considered, May 3rd, 1971. That same day, there was a massive anti-war protest in Washington, D.C. And of course, NPR covered it.
Which was, I think, remarkable and very telling of what we wanted to do. We wanted to be out of the studio. We wanted to use sound to help tell stories and things like that.
1, 2, 3 Army helicopters flying surveillance over the small section of Washington's complicated highway system. A line of young people has just come across the highway. Traffic has stopped. And here come the police. 1, 2, 3, 4 police on motor scooters.
What was hair-raising about this broadcast? Well, consider that ATC was a brand new network program. They planned same-day coverage of a huge protest, and not by phone. Reporters collected tape in the field. They brought it back, dubbed it, edited it, and scrambled to get it ready for the launch of the show at 5 p.m. What do you remember from that day?
Well, I remember being anxious. I was trusting Mike Waters, who I'd worked with in Buffalo, to come through with this program, the documentary, you know. And he did, but it wasn't in the control room exactly when we started. So the host had to punt a little bit.
Wait, are you saying to me that the main content of the very first broadcast of All Things Considered was not queued up and ready to go when the program went live?
That's right.
Were they careful about who they maced?
No. They were... No. There was a priest up there I saw. There were some straight-looking people, you know. They were macing him in the back, you know, which I can't dig. You know, I mean, they were already running, and they were chasing him with the mace in their hair and in their ears and the back of their neck. And there's, you know, they were running away, not towards.
And they maced him in the back.
Yeah. I mean, they all were being maced in the back.
In the end, the final piece covering the protest was over 20 minutes long. I have a picture in my head of the editor in front of a reel-to-reel tape machine with razor blades and wax pencils, arms flailing like a squid out of water to meet the insane deadline.
Tear gas is being fired outside the Department of Agriculture. There weren't a lot of demonstrators here, but when the police moved out, they grabbed as many long-haired young people as they could find, grabbed them and searched them, put them up against walls, buses, cars, searched them. Today in the nation's capital, it is a crime to be young and have long hair.
As we talked about that first broadcast, Bill pointed out something he felt was very important, the opening to the show. The billboard for what was coming up in the program included an excerpt from an interview with a woman with a drug addiction. Here, take a listen.
Once you start doing the drug, often enough, to get to the point where when you wake up in the morning, your nose is running and your stomach is cramping. And, you know, you can't stand for someone to come in there and holler at you. You know, you're totally different. And you're spitting up from the bed to the toilet. You sick. And Harry has knocked on your door.
That anguish surrounds the life of a mother and nurse we call...
There were many other people featured on ATC that day who could have been featured in the billboard, many other topics covered. The protest, of course, hearings in Congress about the Vietnam War, news from the Supreme Court, life in a barbershop. There were even poetry readings on the program, and a weird conversation between William Burroughs and his father. Any of those could have been part of the teaser at the top. But instead, Bill wanted to make sure to lead with an intimate, unrehearsed voice. He says that was a kind of declaration.
That we would not talk about people, we would talk with them.
Can you tell me what you mean?
So often you talk about a drug problem with experts or something, you know, but you don't talk about people that are experiencing it. And that was what this was about. It was the first person telling her story, not someone analyzing the problem.
And that was important to you?
Very. It was a statement of how we're different, how NPR will be different from the other broadcast entities that were out there.
Which were doing what at the time?
Well, it was mainly the voice of authority from New York, you know. It was a white male telling us how it was that day.
There's something else that Bill hears in that voice, intimacy. Intimacy is built into the DNA of radio and podcasting.
Because it's the human voice, that itself is a very telling aspect of emotion. It carries emotion.
My chat with Bill evolved into a larger discussion about the power of the human voice. As evidence, Bill shared a couple of his favorite examples. First, two essays from Kim Williams. Here's Susan Stamberg with an introduction.
Tonight we welcome a new guest commentator to All Things Considered. Our guest commentators present opinions on a broad variety of subjects. Kim Williams will give her ideas on food and nutrition. She teaches a course on edible wild foods at the University of Montana at Missoula. For starters, she offers All Things Considered a recipe, sort of.
I had my first dandelion salad of the spring season today. Wasn't a very big salad because there aren't very many dandelions out yet. I picked mine in my own front yard. I have decided that I had to make a decision this year, whether to spray my dandelions or whether to eat them. I decided to eat them.
And while this is Kim's first essay for NPR. It was recorded in 1976.
As I tell my edible wild foods class, the best place to pick dandelions is under a flatbed truck on the north side of a barn. You might get some good manure there and fertile soil, and you'll have shade.
She has that it communicates a very folksiness, a very folksy quality. It's nothing to do with news or, you know, that kind of thing. It's the way she talks about this with some enthusiasm about dandelion greens and mentions how her husband thinks they're bitter.
I eat the yellow flowers, too, in pancakes. On Sunday mornings, I put one yellow flower on top of each pancake and serve it to my husband, and he says, "You're in your edible wild foods again," and I say, "Yes, sir, eat them up for vitamins and health." This is Kim Williams in Missoula, Montana.
Kim recorded essays about all manner of things for the network. She wrote about clothing, she wrote about marriage, and of course a lot about wild food. She did so for 10 years, until her last one in 1986. Only instead of an essay, it was an interview with Susan about cancer.
What are you saying to yourself these days, Kim?
Well, I'm saying to myself that it is time to move on. That's what it is. It's time to move on.
I'd never heard Kim before, and what struck me is how quickly I felt empathy for her. One three-minute essay about dandelions, followed by this interview about Kim's impending death, and I was really sad to hear the news, all because of her voice. And that response reminded me of an episode of Radiolab where someone said, "Sound is touch at a distance."
Kim, you, one of the pieces in this, let me find it. Quite wonderful. It's something you wrote about a friend who was dying. And this very strong sense you have that death is merely a change and that at some point you say hello to a whole lot of people who you've lost in this life.
Yes, and it is amazing how many letters I've already had before I put out that call, no more letters. How many I have received from people who say... they are going to climb a mountain or walk along a river or on a city street, and they will send their thoughts and energies, and they think that they will meet mine.
I believe that.
I do, too.
Kim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Susan.
Goodbye.
Bye.
The thing is, now, you see, there's so much intense news, and there's so many phone interviews now that Kim wouldn't fit in, I don't think, you know. One of the reasons we called it All Things Considered was because we wanted to include cultural as well as the news. And the new, which doesn't, the new doesn't come from Capitol Hill. It's just old by the time something goes through there. But the new comes in art and other kinds of information and experiences. And I wanted going for 90 minutes, there had to be a less intense kind of listening, if you will, to break it up.
When Bill designed All Things Considered, he envisioned a radio show with a lot of sound textures and colors. And that led our conversation to a piece from David Green. David is now a host for Morning Edition on NPR. Back in 2015, David reported a series of stories pegged to the hearings at the Supreme Court about gay marriage. He traveled to North Dakota to report the series, which was framed pretty simply: people thinking about gay rights and same-sex marriage. Bill says there's one scene in that series that stands out, where Melanie Hoffert, a lesbian, talks to her family about the issue. David starts by setting the scene.
Her parents' house has high ceilings and a living room filled with afternoon sunlight and also Melanie's nieces and nephews. We grabbed slices of pizza from the delivery boxes on the kitchen counter and we sat down around a long dining room table. There was Melanie, her mom, her two brothers, and their wives. We began by talking about...
The family discussed what they remembered about the time when Melanie came out to them years ago. Some family members admitted their responses were not as supportive as they could have been. But the conversation is open and caring.
By now, everyone had had a few slices of pizza, and eventually, the conversation did turn to same-sex marriage. I asked Melanie's mom about it.
I just don't even know why some people are against it, I guess.
I asked her brother David.
No issues with it whatsoever. It should happen.
And her other brother Donnie.
I don't have any conflict whatsoever.
But others were conflicted. David's wife, April, had quietly gotten up when we started talking about this. She was standing in the kitchen, busying herself with the kids. Melanie's other sister-in-law, Julia, stayed at the table, and she talked about her own struggle with gay marriage.
You know, that's actually a really hard question for me.
Julia's devoutly Catholic and says were it not for knowing and loving Melanie, she would see marriage as something that's just between a man and a woman.
I do stand by my faith, and I do believe... what my church says to be true, but I also see where that would hurt somebody. And I know that, that my beliefs and my faith doesn't stand to hurt people either. So I guess it's a hard question for me. April?
April wasn't coming back to the table, and Melanie said she understood why.
I guess I wish she would offer her thoughts because I think the dialogue is important because I love her 100%. I know she loves me 100%. I think that there's probably a very murky area, you know, between our views on this issue, meaning that I don't know that it's exactly black and white for her. And so, I respect her not wanting to talk on the air, but I think that the conversation among us potentially could be something that a lot of people can identify with because they have families are struggling, you know, some families are in further along, some families are so not accepting, and I think really talking about the issue is important. So I respect her for not wanting to talk about it, but I think we will make time after this to sit down and have a discussion, for sure.
As Melanie spoke, Julia was looking at April, who was standing over by the front door, still listening.
So it's not that she didn't want to be here to support Melanie. I mean, obviously she's here, but...
That was April gathering her things and leaving. Everyone at the table was quiet for a few moments.
Do you want us to leave?
I mean, no. I think we're wrapping up anyway, but...
Shortly after we left, Melanie texted us, saying April had misunderstood and thought there was somehow the impression that she doesn't support Melanie. The impression we left with was of a loving family, struggling with something really hard. When Melanie got engaged a few days ago, the whole family congratulated her, every member. Wherever the Supreme Court lands on gay marriage this term, the kinds of conversations we heard all this week are going to go on. They bring to mind something Melanie told us in that abandoned church on the farm where she grew up. People can be conflicted about something and still be thinking out of love.
That's so powerful, mighty powerful, right? David did such a good job setting the scene. The kids, the pizza, the long dining room table, telling us about the family member who got up and stood by the door. Between his descriptions and the voices and the sound, I could see it all. I felt like I was seated there at the table with the family.
Exactly. Exactly. I had the same feeling.
Are those visuals what contributes to intimacy?
Yes. And that's why the listener is engaged in a way they're not with any other medium, because they are creating the picture and they're hearing the voices. Pictures obviously are created in print, but you don't hear the actual voice. And I think that's the power of radio, is that the listener owns the pictures and they can hear the voice, and that helps create the picture. And so that's why you hear people saying, "I just love radio." You know, you don't hear them say, "I just love television." The listener should come to rely upon it as a source of information of consequence, that having listened has made a difference in their attitudes toward the environment and themselves. And then the last part of this section was, listeners should feel that the time spent with NPR was among their most rewarding in media contact. National Public Radio will not regard its audience as a market or in terms of its disposable income, but as curious, complex individuals who are looking for some understanding, meaning, and joy in the human experience.
Ah, Bill, that gets me every time. That's Bill Seemring, a longtime advocate for diversity, craft, and intimacy in audio storytelling and reporting. Thanks for chatting, Bill. Bill has spent much of the last few decades spreading the gospel, if you will, internationally. He's worked to develop community radio in locations where it's a lifeline for news and celebrating culture. For more about Bill, visit transom.org. Right now, the Transom podcast is featuring a series called Pandemic ER, Notes from a Nurse in Queens. It's a series of frontline dispatches from Kate O'Connell. She's a radio producer and an ER nurse, as the title suggests. Lulu Miller, formerly of Invisibilia, describes Kate's series as hypnotic, stunningly honest, and poetic. I agree. Subscribe to the Transom podcast or visit transom.org. This is How Sound, the backstory to great audio storytelling. It's co-produced by PRX and Transom. My huge thanks to John Barth at PRX, and of course to the staff at Transom, Jay Allison, Vicky Merrick, Sid Lewis, and Sam Brown. From a closet in Woods Hole, I'm Rob Rosenthal. Thanks for listening.